Not too long ago, when she was up in her mom's attic, Stephanie Roberts found a box of old letters people had written to her. 200 letters, handwritten. She's got a few of those letters in the studio with her now, and she's finding something to read that will give us a feel for the kind of letters people used to write all the time, just 25 years ago.
Okay. 10 September 91. Stephanie. How are you doing, babe? I hope everything is going your way. Life down here is okay. Sure was a big change. Owen and I are looking for our own place in Sacramento. We just can't settle down until we have our own home. Owen is working in Sac, too, and the commute is an hour each way, so that's a drag also. I'm going to skip a little bit to the end here. This is wonderful. She says, I miss you, Lara. P.S. I can feel the baby now. P.P.S. If you see John F., tell him to write me. P.P.S.S. I expect a postcard from every country. Love you.
Aw, I love all the postscripts. Stephanie has turned some of the letters in that box she found into a play, premiering as part of the Kansas City Fringe Festival this weekend. It's called Write to Me. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard and Stephanie Roberts. Thanks for being here and reading your personal letters.
Thank you.
Where did the idea come from to turn these letters into a play?
Well, as you mentioned, I found them a couple of years ago. And as I was looking through them, I started to think about how not everyone has a box like this, because part of that has to do with a generation. My students, you know, my younger friends who didn't have this kind of communication out of necessity. So really, if you didn't want a huge phone bill and you wanted to stay in touch with people, you had to write letters. But also, as I was reading them, the kind of slow communication and the material that came out of that, how we communicated with each other, is very different from 140 characters, or even typing in an email. I was surprised at how emotional and how revealing and vulnerable people were in writing.
You know, I wonder if that's because you couldn't get it out a little bit at a time, so you had to really go there with everything. Like when you had an emotion that you wanted to share with a friend, like you said, you couldn't necessarily call all the time, and the only other way was this sort of time-consuming process that someone's going to receive this a few days later at the earliest. So mm-hmm. It can't just be like, blah, this is what I feel right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. I talk about letters give you the gift of time. So it's the gift of time for people to respond, as well as the gift of time to really sit with your thoughts and sit alone with one person who might be thousands of miles away, but you are really concentrating. You don't have five screens on. You don't, you know, that dedicated, slow, mindful connection.
When you first found this box of letters, how long had it been since people had written them to you?
The last letter, I think, was around 2002.
Mm-hmm. Are they from people you are still in touch with?
Yes, some not. I mentioned this in the play. After I found all of these, I didn't know what to do with them. I knew I was going to do something with them. So I just started writing letters again, almost as research. And I wrote to a lot of the people who had written me letters, who I was Facebook friends with or whatever. And most people just wrote one letter, thanked me, you know. But then one friend in particular, I started a correspondence with again. And so I've gotten maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 letters from her since, you know. But most of them there were some people. There was one person that was from Europe. I met in Europe, and I have a lot of letters from people I met in pensions and, you know, and
kind of a trip?
This was backpacking through Europe. I mentioned in the play also. You know, I was 2 years out of college and I backpacked through Europe for 2 months on my own. And I would just meet people along the way and we would stay in touch and write letters. And one person wrote me several letters and I found him on Facebook. And so we just, you know, exchanged a few messages and that's been fun.
So tell me a little bit more about the group of people, particularly like the friend group mm-hmm. who's all staying in touch, because mm-hmm. these people become the characters in your play,
yes.
even though they're becoming characters in a fairly unconventional way.
Yes, yes. So these three characters or friends are from college. One of them was my my roommate, Alexia, and two of them were my best friends also, Laura and Julie. And we went to school together at Cornish College of the Arts in Seattle. And they became, you know, we were 18, 19, 20, 21, you know, and this became my second family. And so, as I mentioned, I saw one of them give birth. I was in the delivery room. So we were very, very close. And
is there kind of like a type you would say you all are or were?
Yes. Just yesterday when I was looking through them to bring some here, I realized that we were all dreamers. You know, that even though the voice and the style of all of three are very different, we were, you know, we were 18 years old going to acting school, you know, in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s. And so we all had this dream you know, dream of fame or dream of whatever, you know, making it. And so all of the letters kind of do reflect that.
So in the play, the letters are read sort of interwoven with your thoughts mm-hmm. about reflecting back, not just on the people and mm-hmm. what they mean to you, but also on what it was like to receive letters like this. Mm-hmm. There's also cello music.
Yes.
One of the things I really enjoyed reading the script for this play is how the character of you now looks at people who, when you received these letters, they were your contemporaries, they were your peers. Mm-hmm. But now they're much younger.
Yes.
And you have this sort of almost maternal protectiveness.
Yes.
That changes how you read what they're sharing with you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's it. You know, maternal, I talk about that in the play, how, you know, the 49-year-old Stephanie is very different from the 23 to 26-year-old, where I was kind of, I was on the same page. I could totally relate with what they were going through. And now I look back, not only with nostalgia, but with more experience and wisdom, and sometimes it's comic to me because I recognize my young self in that, and sometimes it is protective because we were taking huge risks back then,
such as
one of my friends who was living in her car in LA, you know, for 3 months.
Why was she living in her car for 3 months?
You know, I haven't. That's one of the things is some of these things are surprising because I can't remember events until I read it. And also, you know, we have lost touch throughout the years. And so that's not something that I might bring up, you know, first when I do see them. But I think it was just the struggle of being on your own, probably not wanting to ask for help, being very independent. And it just literally back then you had to pay. Pound the pavement. You had to bring your headshots and resumes to people's, you know, offices.
You were young acting mm-hmm. professionals mm-hmm. or trying to become young acting professionals.
Right, right. Yeah.
There's a letter that you read in the play, and I won't give away too much about mm-hmm. it, but this friend who was living in her car, she refers to this as her unstable living situation, and she does it in kind of almost a jokey, nonchalant mm-hmm. kind of way, mm-hmm. and refers to it being a shock to her white middle class system.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you remember how you read that at the time, but that's a pretty, to read that now when you aren't also a young person taking those same risks, mm-hmm. how does it feel?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had to piece through these letters because she was so cryptic about it. She never really One of them that I don't include in the play actually does say, I'm in my car. But others said, I don't have an apartment, or I have, quote unquote, unstable living situation. And I just assumed she was couch surfing with my other friends who lived in LA, right? And I think probably at the time when I read it, that might have been what I assumed as well. And, you know, part of it is that back then I was probably just consumed with myself and my own struggles. And I probably didn't worry about her as much because I thought, oh, you know, she'll be okay. You know, now it's got almost devastating to me looking back and thinking, oh my gosh, she needed help.
You know, when I have a similar box of letters, although it's from a different period in my life. It's more late childhood through maybe it kind of ends when I'm about 18 or 19. And what's interesting to me is not just how I respond differently to the letters, but also which letters matter to me the most has changed. Like when you're a teenager, the letter from your friend telling you who did what this weekend kind of stuff is a big deal. And now that stuff kind of is like blah, 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 blah as mm-hmm. I read that stuff. Mm-hmm. But letters from like my brother, you know, he was a freshman in college when I was a freshman in high school, and he's writing me a letter that reveals to me indirectly that he has been kind of looking out for me. He tells me, you know, I was about to go to the dance with some guy and he's called his friends to ask about him and to make sure he's okay. And he's letting me know that he's done that. And I read that letter and see so much caring, and it rises to the surface mm-hmm. in this really incredible way. Mm-hmm. Did you have that experience?
Yes. In fact, I'm going to bring out another letter that is not in the play, but that I brought with me. Again, it's nostalgic to me at how open and emotional and vulnerable we were. She says, this is Laura again, and she says, I miss being at Cornish for the first time in a long time today, and the reason is because I don't see you as often as I did when we were at school. It's ironic that you sometimes appreciate people the most or realize how much you care for them when they're not around. I love you, and I hope you're having a lovely day. You know, so just how much people said, I love you, I miss you.
And that they don't know, they can't know what's going to be happening with you when you get the letter. Mm-hmm. So it's full of hopes and mm-hmm. wishes.
Yeah. I also, and my collaborators, Alex Williams, my musician, and then my assistant director, Catherine Mungai, we recognized as we were trying to stage these or come up with a tone for the music that each and for the overall piece, that each letter, it can be at really dark or really go to some really vulnerable places and painful places, but they always try to end it on a positive note. So as it's like they don't want to leave you with that. They want to leave you with a hope, whether it's we'll be okay and I know my life is going to get better, or I hope everything's going well with, you know, it ends in a smile. And that was really interesting to me.
Do you remember your own letter writing style? I mean, your own letters are probably not there unless mm-hmm. you are like me and wrote several drafts in many cases, in which case you might have some drafts hovering around.
You know, I have a couple letters that were mine that either I didn't send, I chose not to send them, or they came back to me because that person had moved. And I wrote, and then I have people referring to my writing, and that it's really like almost like a journal entry. So it's a little bit like, I talk about what's in front of me. I talk about, you know, what I'm eating or having coffee right, you know, what the weather is like, what, you know, it's painting the picture for them first before I kind of get into the meaty stuff. And I've written a ukulele song that's in the show, which is a kind of composite letter from me that kind of shows a little bit, I think, of how I was writing back then.
You talked about how people leave on this up note, no matter what the letter says. Is there a convention you noticed about how letters begin?
Yeah.
Other than Dear Stephanie.
Yeah. Hi, hun. How you doing, babe? You know, there's a lot of just terms of endearment, which were great.
Things that people didn't really say to each
other. No, I don't remember them calling me babe, but all of, you know, several of them do.
Has this project changed you in any way? Just delving into all of these letters and thinking about that style of communication or the people you communicated with?
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think that I think about those close ties. I've definitely started writing a lot of letters again, and it makes me curious about those friends. It makes me curious about my ties right now, with friends. And
in what way? What are you curious about?
About staying in touch. That friendships, like any relationship, is work. That you really do have to make the effort to stay in touch. You know, we stopped staying in touch because of email and cell phones, and yet
that's not staying in touch.
Well, no, I said we stopped. I mean, we stopped writing rather because of emails and cell phones. We stopped writing. And then in my case, that was the excuse and that's what we were going to do. And yet we didn't. So the distance still kept us from staying connected.
Stephanie Roberts, thanks for talking to me about your letters and your new play, Write to Me.
Thank you.
Write to Me will be performed at the Writer's Place starting this Saturday. Go to kcfringe.org for details. Up next, a new musical, but no show tunes. It's all folk music, but also funny. The director joins us on KCUR's Central Standard after this break. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're joined by a singer, songwriter, theater director about town, V-Tran. He's got a new show performing premiering tomorrow in the Buffalo Room at the Westport Flea Market. It's a musical and a comedy, but you won't hear any show tunes. As for what you'll hear instead, I will give you a hint.
Glory, glory, hallelujah, when I lay my burden down. Glory, hallelujah, when I lay my burden down. I was standing by my window on a cold and a cloudy day when I saw that.
It's a modern-day folk music comedy called Will the Circle, in reference to...
Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
V-Tran, good morning.
Good morning.
Where did the idea for this musical come from?
Well, that came from playwright Elsie Bernadine, who was writing a show about a block party. And then she was listening to a lot of Kevin Welch music at the time, and she...
And this is not Kevin Welch, this is the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yes, yes. Kevin is a fantastic folk Americana artist, and she just saw some thematic tie-ins with Kevin's music and the play that she was writing. And so she decided to put the two together. She reached out to Kevin and said, "Hey, I love your songs. I love them for this play that I'm writing. How would you feel if I made a folk musical about it?"
So. The idea of a folk musical kind of cracks me up because I feel like in some ways show tunes and folk songs are on opposite ends of a spectrum. Like in musicals, performers really ham it up with choreographed numbers and jazz hands and stuff like that. And folk music, it doesn't have to be, but it can be very solemn. Like dancing to a folk song is often something you might just call swaying.
Right, right. But you know, I think that folk music and musical theater, I think don't need to be defined so narrowly. I mean, from the Folk Alliance International being here in Kansas City now for the last few years, I've learned so much more about folk music and how wide-ranging it can be. You know, it can be that solemn storytelling that you're talking about, but it can be a jamboree, right? You know, it can be out in the woods on the campfire, or in the case of Will the Circle, on a porch at a block party, you know, and it can be at the same time, the common threads are storytelling. It's telling your story.
So are the roots of your involvement in this premiere, does that go back to the Folk Music Alliance?
Oh, no. This isn't affiliated with Folk Alliance. That was just more of my education in folk. And as a folk musician myself, just seeing how wide-ranging it can be. My involvement in this project started when I met Elsie at the William Inch Theater Festival. I directed a 10-minute play of hers, and we just really hit it off. And I got an email from her later, and she had looked me up and saw that I was a singer-songwriter as well. And she said, I have this folk musical. Would you like to come up and direct it for the Chicago Music Theater Festival? And so I went up there, and we just really, really hit it off. And it was the beginning of a beautiful friendship and collaborative relationship. And I loved directing her work. I loved directing that show. And even last summer while I was up there in Chicago, I said, I want to give it its Kansas City premiere. You know, I want another crack at this show.
So let's talk about the block party where this play is set, this musical. It's young people who are sort of, I don't know, I get the feeling they're probably in their 20s.
Yeah. Late 20s, early 30s, you know, and it's evaluating, especially in today's climate, you know, that divide. You know, we hear a lot about, oh, well, them millennials and the climate that we're in. And so there's this invisible line that's being drawn
between them and the rest of the block residents.
Exactly.
They're apartment dwellers.
They're apartment dwellers, not homeowners like the rest, who are more established and seem to have their lives figured out and sorted out. And I think it's the same way, you know, between apartment dwellers and homeowners, or haves, have-nots, and just the kind of the tense times that we're living in right now. Block parties, according to LC, have always been a neighborhood's beer and brats version of keep calm, carry on, you know.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, the British phrase, keep calm, carry on. It's like no matter what happens, no matter what tension is in the air or what dangers seem to lurk around the corner, we're going to keep calm and carry on. And in a block party, it's like all things are forgiven. It doesn't matter where you're from. You know, we're here to celebrate the neighborhood.
But I'm still going to tell you to turn your music down later tonight.
That's right. Or if they get a little too imbibed at the block party, maybe they'll turn the music up. Maybe they'll bust out the karaoke machine. Who knows? You know, once they put the kids to bed. But it is it's a charming, quirky musical analyzing our fears right now, and our possibly paranoia or feelings of dysfunction or separation, and instead just taking a look at, like, what does it mean to be a neighbor? What does it mean to reach across the aisle?
You know, that's interesting, because it's hard to tell, since this is really, like, mostly from these younger people's perspective, whether they really are outcasts or if they imagine that people are judging them.
Right. And it's tough. But I think that comes from a human place as well. We always have to remind ourselves, does the world revolve around us? You know, what is our part in reaching out and being a neighbor as well? But I think that fears are valid, and feelings are valid. Fears cause us to have certain feelings, but feelings are valid. How you feel is how you feel. But let's analyze what is it that separates us.
So there are, I would say, three main characters.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about each of them?
Sure. Brendan is kind of the glue of this story. He has been brought to this block party to entertain the kiddos as a musician, right? And he's there to support his friend Annalise, who's on the block party planning committee. And she's one that is there in the neighborhood staying with her fiancé, Peter. And she feels a little separated. You know, it seems like the rest of the established block party committee are those queen bees who live in the neighborhood and who own their homes. And so she feels a little bit of separation, and Brennan's there for moral support. And then their friend Trey is kind of sarcastic and a ne'er-do-well.
Yeah, he calls himself a block party freelancer.
A block party freelancer, yeah. He lives like a block away, and so he wanders over and he helps them get into shenanigans, which include a little bit of mild breaking and entering. You know, it's like, hey, you feel separated? Let's remove the separation. Let's bust into Muriel's house. Let's bust into the Rivera's house. You know, it's a block party. Everyone's supposed to be welcome, right? So if you feel separated, let's remove the separation.
Let's make that circle unbroken.
That's right. That's right.
So there's something Trey says. I think it was Trey at one point that intrigued me. And I'm going to quote from this script. I hope that's all right.
Sure, absolutely.
He says, I wish we had more history, like we're 65 and lived through a major event or two, maybe a gas explosion where no one got hurt. That comment felt interesting to me. Like, right now, I feel like people wish they could have just one boring news week. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And so this guy kind of wistfully wishing he had really been through something, even if he's a young person, it's just so hard for me to wrap my mind around that. Can you tell me a little bit more about that line and that sentiment?
Oh, goodness. That's you've sprung a good one on me, Gina. Well, you know, I kind of feel and can relate too, in that, you know, I've lived through some stuff, but it was my parents who lived through a great war, you know, and the generation before them lived through the great wars, you know, World War I, World War II. It's like every generation is defined by a war. And I know that we've had, you know, conflicts recently as well. But right now we're in this period where I think it's constant anxiety because we're not in the middle of a major war, but there's always conflict and there's always something in the news cycle and there's always something to keep us on edge.
Or do you think maybe it's that we're like in this country a little bit protected from those conflicts that are happening? Like they're happening.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. They are happening, you know, but it's like, Trey is saying that, you know, I want to experience danger, but not have the consequences. Like no one gets hurt. No one gets hurt, you know, but I want to be in that gas explosion. But I want to make sure that no one, everyone walks away from it and it's okay. But at least I can say I've had that experience.
I thought a lot about that moment in this play. And it got me thinking about that in mainstream pop culture, there's this love of youth and that's very well acknowledged. But I feel like maybe there's a counterculture thing, and this is what I maybe picked up on, I think, that's going on right beside that love of youth, where there's also sort of like a hipster love of old things and old people and romanticization of what it's like to have history.
Sure. I think that there's a validity to that because, what we talk about the millennial generation right now is it's a generation in stasis, you know. They're too old to be young, but too young to be old, you know. And so I think there is that wistfulness of looking forward and looking back and being like, when do I graduate? When do I get out of this limbo, you know? Because I'm getting it from either side, you know. The young kids behind me are saying, you're old. And then the old people ahead of me are saying, you haven't got it figured out yet, you know. But I think that above and beyond the hot take feel about millennials right now is that's also as old as the fabric of time. You know, there's always that transition in that crucible period in the span of a lifetime.
Do you have a favorite moment in this play, or a moment that really got you thinking differently about how people in, I don't know, I'm guessing your generation, you seem millennial, Gen X, cuspy to me.
Yeah,
how we live.
I'm the Oregon Trail generation. That's the title that I've latched onto. Analog childhood, digital adulthood. There's this moment, and you know, Elsie and Kevin were so wonderful in giving us free license to play around with the arrangements. And there are two songs of Kevin's: one called "Answer Me That," and one called "Too Old to Die Young." And they give me the liberty to kind of mash them up because I wanted to explore the themes in those songs as a conversation.
What are the themes in those songs?
They're both questions, you know. Rather than giving answers, they're saying, you know, if this, then that kind of questions. And all these things are going on in the world, and so answer me that, you know. One character at one point, she talks about a traumatic experience, and Brendan doesn't have an answer for her, so he sings this song instead. He starts singing this song, and it's filled with more questions, and that inspires her then to start singing "Too Old to Die Young." And it's about mortality, and it's about surviving danger, you know. You never know what's lurking around the corner. I like rather than laying out an answer, it's just asking more questions. Rather than telling someone, hey, I have all the answers, and this is the definitive solution to these strifes and these conflicts, it's like, no, let's continue to ask more questions. Ask more questions to inspire each other to have more conversations and have more dialogue, you know, and then maybe perhaps stumbling like we do a song being born out of nowhere, maybe we'll stumble upon an answer together.
There's a style of banter in this play that I'd love for you to comment on. I mean, do you think that there's a style of banter that characterizes a generation too?
I think so.
Tell me about it.
Oh gosh, we're kind of right in the middle of it, and so we're analyzing and explicating it as it happens. So it's hard to be definitive, but I think that I mean, we've seen it in the climate now. I mean, it's the Twitter 140 characters onto the next subject, and it's kind of
the witty repartee.
Exactly, the witty repartee, but that's always existed, but you know, it's different than being in someone's antechamber and just trading barbs over a patient and period evening. Rather, now it's like snappy, snappy, snappy.
It's like improv comedy,
right?
All the time,
right. And we see it with the character of Peter, the fiance. He's like, you know, I don't know what it's like to be part of your circle because you guys have all of this, you know, kind of back and forth, really quirky humor, you know, kind of thing.
Your own language,
yeah, your own language. And I think that's what it is learning to speak each other's language, you know. So I hope that that's what Will the Circle will show us.
V-Tran, director of Will the Circle, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck tomorrow night.
Thank you, Gina.
Will the Circle will have its Kansas City premiere tomorrow at the Buffalo Room as part of the Kansas City Fringe Festival. We're headed to a break, and then we'll switch gears to uncover a little-known piece of Johnson County history, something called a poor farm that used to exist on 119th Street. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for more Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. On 119th and Ridgeview Road in Johnson County, there used to be something called a poor farm. That term is totally jarring to the modern ear. It sounds horribly insensitive and maybe like forced labor, but it was another time period's model for helping the homeless. For the rest of today's show, we'll be getting a picture of what the poor farm was and the attitude toward poverty it represents. I'll start by talking to journalist and local history guy Monroe Dodd. Hi, Monroe.
Good morning, Gina.
What can you tell us about Johnson County's poor farm?
Johnson County's poor farm was like scores of other counties in Kansas and in Missouri and across the Middle West. The legislatures typically said, thou shalt fix some way, you counties, to help the poor. And so the poor farm in its noblest incarnation was a place where the general public would pay through their taxes to give a place for the poor and what they were called in the feeble-minded, the deaf, blind, other people, a place to go as opposed to just wandering out into the fields and dying. So that was a good sense of it. Though in their worst sense, though, they were considered pretty Dickensian. Bad food, unsanitary facilities, too much work, abuse by the people who oversaw them. The Johnson County Poor Farm supposedly supported itself because people raised livestock and crops and they were sold, and all was well and good through the 1800s, early 1900s. Really, all wasn't well and good. But as the Kansas City Star said in 1908, the poor farms are kind of a place.
This is 1908?
1908. That the poor farms, there's a lot of injustices that have been reported by then for poor farms in Jackson County, Clay County. He said that justices resulted from a popular cowardice that hides these institutions from the general view. There is too much of a disposition to forget that they exist. And actually, that may be the worst thing about it of all. The public was supposed to support these people, but actually what it wound up being was public money used to put people away somewhere out of sight.
When you say that the farm supported itself, that's interesting. I mean, I had read, you know, it's self-sustaining. It's like a family farm. Could people just choose to go there and set up camp or something? How did people become residents of the poor farm, or, you know, make themselves a part of this community, if you'd even call it that?
Typically, it was through some kind of court action. A family could no longer support grandpa. Sometimes it was other things, such as a father.
So wait, a family could send grandpa to the poor farm?
Would go to the court and say, we can no longer support this man. Then the court would send him to the poor farm. There are lots of ways for that to happen. Courts could also adjudge parents morally unfit. And a parent near Buckner in the early 20th century, a man whose wife had died and had about six kids, the court said, your three youngest boys, you're morally unfit to have them. We're sending them to the Jackson County Poor Farm, which was down near Lee's Summit.
And so then they would go there, and in what conditions would they live?
Often in some kind of building. Sometimes it was an overcrowded building, depending on the size of the county. But they would then go out and do work, which was supposedly pay back the county for stuff. And then when the kids were 21 and able to support themselves, or even 18 able to support themselves, they would be freed. Now, there was also a downside to the children, too. Some counties basically farmed out kids as apprentices. Kids at the poor farm, put them to work with private companies under who knows what kind of conditions, unmonitored entirely, in return for which the county would get money.
And were the kids going to school when they were living on the poor farm, or no?
I am not familiar with any schooling going on at the poor farms, not in the 1800s and early, the late 1800s and early 20th century. Now, poor farms passed from the scene toward the middle of the 20th century and were updated. One of the evolutions of the poor farm was that states began to make up institutions for children and the child criminals, for the deaf, for the people called insane. The Jackson County Poor Farm, all the people designated insane in it were moved in the late 1890s to Fulton, Missouri, where there was a lunatics asylum. That's what it was called. And that then narrowed the number of people at the poor farm and the demographic of it to the poor, and eventually became basically the aged and the infirm.
I'm going to get back to the Johnson County Poor Farm shortly, but Megan Burke is now joining us from the University of Texas in the Rio Grande Valley, although right now she's in Ohio researching the history of poor farms throughout the Midwest for a book she's working on. Hi, Megan.
Good morning, Gina.
What sort of, I don't know, when you think about poor farms throughout the Midwest, is there an attitude toward poverty, toward homelessness that you think this encapsulates?
Well, I'm not sure that there is a kind of single homogenous attitude about poverty. people definitely accepted the fact that it was a part of life and that there were people whose families couldn't take care of them, that there were people who had no family. And a lot of these people who ended up at the poor farm actually worked their whole lives and at the end of their life find themselves without anyone to provide physical care or mental health services or any of the things that sometimes people need as they age or get sick and injured. So there is definitely a feeling of obligation. Each county and most of the counties in the Midwestern states had a poor farm at one point in time. So it's a fairly common institution for the 19th and early 20th centuries. But every county is a little bit different in terms of the type and quality of care that they give. So some counties invested a lot of money in the type of building. They wanted it to look nice. They wanted it to be decent inside. You're never going to find one that's luxurious. Some of them prided themselves on providing good, healthy food, lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and things like that. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And those institutions definitely fit a stereotype of a dark, dank, horrible place that you wouldn't want to have to live.
What time period are we talking about?
Well, a sort of a county type institution to take care of people who are poor or sick has been around as long as the United States has existed.
But they
become a lot more popular after the Civil War when counties and states alike are taking more responsibility for people who need help, in part because they've got a lot of returning veterans or widows and orphans from the Civil War who all need care, but also people feel like they deserve care. They've made a considerable sacrifice for the country, and it's appropriate to take better care of those people. And that sentiment, that feeling of we have a responsibility here, extends out to not just veterans or their widows, children, and those people. It extends a little farther. So a lot of the counties that you find opening poor farms are opening them by the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s.
Talk to me more about the farm component of the poor farm. Is that always literal, like that people are growing food or raising livestock?
It's usually very literal. Counties invested different amounts of money in different acreage. So sometimes you'll find counties with a few hundred acres, which is a big farm for that time period. Sometimes you'll find counties with maybe 80 to 100 acres. But one of the misconceptions about the poor farm is that the people who lived there are doing the labor. Generally speaking, if you lived at the poor farm as a resident, it meant that you were not able to do a lot of meaningful labor. You weren't able to self-support. So usually the institutions are full of people who can't do much. They may be able to help in the garden. They may be able to maybe tend to a couple of animals. But these farms are staffed by a superintendent usually, and that person normally has a family, a wife who provides a lot of the kind of domestic work. And a lot of counties actually hired hands. They had workers on the farm that they paid a wage because the people that they're taking care of are not really equipped to be farm laborers. You know, it's hard physical work. They're growing a lot of food for the institution. They've usually got grain crops. They've got livestock. Some poor farms actually invested in really good quality herds of animals. Some of them end up as kind of a county experiment station. So they are very much working farms.
You know, that's interesting. Monroe, from what the very little bit I was able to get my hands on to read about Johnson County's poor farm, it sounded to me like it was the residents working on the farm, but maybe that was a misunderstanding.
No, I don't think it's a misunderstanding. I think it's a fact that when you put this county, that county, the other county, numbering 105, well, not all 105 counties in Kansas, but most of them, and many of the 114 counties in Missouri and so on, you're going to get differences in the way things operate. Johnson County's poor farm, total about 150 acres, and people, yeah, work there. They raise corn and oats and cattle, hogs and chickens, and these things got sold. So Johnson County, and it's which was, you got to remember, in the 19th and early 20th century, this is a largely rural county. Olathe is the biggest town in it, and Olathe wasn't a very big town. 119th in Ridgeview, which is now, by the way, the Johnson County Governmental Plaza, where the health department and other things hold forth. That was the site of the old poor farm, and Johnson County ran it like a farm. It was, after all, rural Kansas. Jackson County, kind of different. I think the term poor farm and poor house, asylum, and other things could be kind of interchangeable at the time. The general idea was, what are we going to do with these people? Ah, let's send them to the poor farm.
Megan, what got you interested enough in the poor farms to be doing this research? I mean, you were talking about misconceptions about poor farms, and maybe I'm just an outlier here, but I didn't have any misconceptions because I never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of our living memory of the institutions themselves preceded us by a couple of generations. People that can remember the institutions, their buildings, people who might have lived there, has kind of slipped away from our living memory. I came across them not just as a product of two Midwestern farm families, but because my previous book is about the process of placing children out from institutions onto farms. And so a lot of institutions did that. There were county children's homes, there are poor farms doing it, there are state institutions. And it's a really common practice to put a child who is dependent on a county or state onto a farm property with a farm family to essentially work for room and board. And so I used a lot of poor farm records to chart the progress and the process of putting children with farmers as laborers. But I didn't have a lot of time in a book about children to explore what it's like for adults and different life cycles, in fact, of adults, not just the elderly, not just the young, but at poor farms serve all ages of people. And so I'm now able to kind of go back and take a different look at the types of populations that poor farms served and really the pretty important position that they had in most Midwestern communities.
Why was this a phenomenon in the Midwest in particular?
Well, a lot of areas have something similar. You can go out west to California and Oregon and find county poor farms. You can go down south. They are more numerous in the Midwest. Most counties in Kansas had one. Most counties in other Midwestern states had one. In Ohio, every county had one at some point. By the time you get to places like Texas, Texas has 270 some counties, but only 65 of them ever open a poor farm. And it's a difference of how states and counties look at social welfare provisions. So in the Midwest, it was seen as a good investment for the county to buy land. Obviously, like Monroe mentioned, Johnson County is still using theirs, just in a different way, but the county is still utilizing that land, and that's the case for a lot of them. So the view that land, you know, always appreciates and that it's a good investment for counties prompts a lot of counties to make that investment and use it to help people in need. And social welfare benefits and expenditures tended to be lower in southern states, just traditionally speaking, historically speaking. And by the time you get to the East Coast, you're dealing with things like almshouses and workhouses that are facets of a previous time where most of poor law or poor aid in the United States is coming from England. And so they're using a slightly more urbanized setting.
Megan,
so it's got a little different feel.
As you've sort of visited sites and dug into history, documents, and that kind of thing, is there a character or a story that you have uncovered that has really struck a nerve for you?
Oh, gosh. There are a few. I found one a couple of weeks ago that is closer to where I'm from in Northwest Ohio of a poor farm in a county that existed for a long time, but it was never known as being very nice. And I found a woman who was admitted to the poor farm when she was 16, and this would have been in 1930. And when she died after 2000, she was considered the last living resident of the county's poor farm. Now, the poor farm had changed. It had turned into a county nursing facility, but she spent the whole of her life there. And she actually was joined by two of her siblings, and they checked in during the 1940s, and they stayed until their deaths. And so one of the things that I do is try to figure out what the event is that triggers someone going to the poor farm, whether it's a family crisis or a health crisis. I'm interested in the causes of a fairly crippling poverty and how counties handle that. But she's going to stick with me for a while because spending your whole life at a place like that is something I think to be grateful for when you don't have to.
You know, is it like the Hotel California? You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. I mean, do people leave the poor farm?
They do leave the poor farm, yeah. Some people are there just because they're sick or injured, and so as soon as they get better, they hightail it out of there. Some people come and go, you know, when the weather turns cold and work is starting to dry up, they go in, they spend the winter staying warm and getting something to eat, and spring comes and off they go.
Megan Burke of the University of Texas in the Rio Grande Valley, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Gina.
And Monroe Dodd, your knowledge of local history is always so fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
You can listen back to all of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have it ready for you by the end of the day. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudd Hope, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.